reach the Outrider Podcast.
All right. Welcome to episode 9 of the Outrider Podcast. I am Jason Quinn Malott, your host here. You know, one of the problems with learning by doing is you end up doing a lot of things wrong and struggling and making mistakes. And getting this podcast ready for this Monday has been a pain in my butt. And that's been really the only problem. I mean, the last two have been difficult for me to get ready, although the conversations themselves have been fabulous. I hope you've enjoyed the Colin Dickey conversation, despite my ranty intro. I apologize for that, Colin. But today we've got Peter Guy, and Peter is the author of Safe from the Sea and The Lighthouse Road, both from Unbridled Books. They are fabulous books. If you haven't read them already, go out and get them. And I hope you enjoy the conversation that I have here with Peter today. And let's get right to it so that I don't do something horrible and put my foot in my mouth or say something that would put you in a bad mood before we get to my conversation with Peter. You should be excited for this. This should be fun. And Peter's a great guy, and we had a great conversation. So let's get right to it and talk to Peter Guy about everything.
Hello.
Hello, Peter.
Jason, how are you?
Not too bad. How are you?
I'm all right. I should say I have a terrible cough, actually. So hopefully, I just got some new cough suppressant. Hopefully, it will help, and I won't be hacking it up while we're talking.
Oh, that's right. Travel will take it out of you. You've been kind of all over the place lately, right?
Well, you know, a fair amount. Yes, it's true, but I think it's more like little kids will bring it home to you.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
You have three, right?
Yeah, three little ones.
How little?
8, and we'll be 6 in a week, and just turned 4. So third grader, a kindergartner, and a preschooler.
Right, and they bring home all sorts of funky bugs.
Oh, man, that's just unbelievable, the crap that they track in here. It actually do pretty well. I mean, for as often as I've been, you know, I mean, as long as I've had them and been doing this, I haven't really been waylaid much, but this one got a hold of me and has not let go.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
You've got practice. Oh, I'm doing okay. I'm managing to stay away from the kid germs. I did spend a year once working at a middle school as a paraprofessional. This was before I went to graduate school. I wanted to see if I was teaching material.
Yeah.
And the worst head cold I ever got was from a fifth grader.
Yeah. I have no trouble believing that.
He showed up and he had snot smeared down the front of his sweatshirt.
Mm.
I worked with the gifted instructor. I'm helping her. And he showed up and was trying to do his math homework. And he was having a problem with something. And he held out his pencil for me to use. And I looked at it for a minute. And I looked around for something else, and there was nothing else, you know, to grab. I should have gotten up and did something, but I just kind of went, well, took his pencil, you know, helped him with the problem, gave it back to him. And I thought to myself, tomorrow I'm going to be in hell.
And you were.
Sure enough. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been there 100 times. I mean, when you have your own kids, it gets much worse. And, you know, I mean, it's like they come home and they're crying. So you pick them up and they sneeze in your face and, you know, you're literally ingesting what they're bringing home. But yeah, you don't even have to do that. You just have to be in the neighborhood and this crap will track you down.
Oh yeah. So you've apparently got a very large family, right? I saw a picture.
Well, I mean, just you mean my extended family?
Well, I did. There was a picture I had seen. Well, this reminds me, how do you pronounce your last name?
Guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
Thought I'd make sure though.
Yeah,
before I like
it.
Go and record the intro and get it wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I do appreciate it. You wouldn't be the first person that got it wrong, I'll tell you that. So you saw what? What did you see?
It was a picture on Facebook. you made it. It gave me a clue as to how you might pronounce your last name, because it was like, look at all the guys, and it had just had this swath of people.
Well, there's five of us kids. I have four siblings.
Wow.
And they're all married, and all but one of them has a family of their own. You know, so that, yeah, I mean, it's not a small family gathering when we all get together, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about you?
Relatively small. Just my immediate family. There's my sister and I. Of course, I have a half-brother who's 30 years younger than I am.
From your father's?
Second marriage.
Second marriage, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. That's a whole strange story in and of itself.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with that kid, because my dad passed a few years ago.
Oh, geez.
After a car accident, so it was nothing expected.
Yeah.
But, yeah, my dad had found God, as if you had to look for him.
Yeah.
After he divorced my mother, who oddly enough was a preacher's kid.
Oh, that's some sort of fantastic insult, huh?
Yeah. Wow. So, and yeah, apparently my little half brother is in Buffalo now with his mother, who hates me because I'm a Buddhist.
Wow. Are you so you don't have any or much contact with the kid?
No. Yeah. After the eulogy, the wife kind of took off from the funeral and disappeared. She hated it that much. So how about that?
Wow, that's a sad story.
Sorry. Oh, I like to make it's all right.
Yeah.
Huh. So you all this big family you've got, these five kids. Are they all still in the Minneapolis area?
No, my brother is, and I'm great pals with my brother. He's 5 years younger than me. But I have three sisters, and they all live out west, two of them in Southern California and one of them in Phoenix, just outside of Phoenix, although actually now they just moved into Phoenix. So they all live out among the sand instead of the snow.
Yeah, probably got tired of the snow.
Yeah, exactly. They followed each other out there as soon as they had reason or means to go, and they haven't been back since. Oh, that's not true. My youngest sister came and lived back home for a little while, but her husband, who's a great guy, was no fan of Minnesota from October through April, as most people aren't.
Yeah. Now I've got a friend up there, Brian Ferry, writes YA books and middle grade stuff. He's published by Harper and Simon Pulse, lives up there in the St. Paul area.
Huh. What's his last name? Ferry?
Ferry, F-A-R-R-E-Y.
I don't think I've ever met him or even heard of him. Yeah.
Well, it's not like, well, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul. I've been there at least once in my life so far, and it's not small.
No, not at all. I mean, the metropolitan area is actually pretty enormous, both geographically and population-wise. So, you're where? Down in Missouri or something,
in
right?
Kansas. Yeah. Kansas. Yeah.
Go right next door. Yeah. And you are you from there?
More or less. Yeah.
Yeah.
My dad was from Kansas. My mom's family was from Chicago. And my grandfather was a minister, so he moved around a lot. And, yeah.
Excellent.
Now, you grew up in Minneapolis, right? And that's got a pretty good literary scene, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's got a tremendous literary scene. And yes, I did grow up here. In fact, I've lived here with the exception of graduate school years. Mm-hmm. I've lived here my whole life. I love it. It's it's really a tremendous place to live, not just from the standpoint of how great it is for bookish sorts, but just altogether. I mean, you have to deal with the winters, it's true, but it's also, you know, I mean, that it's a healthy place. It's a, you know, there's parks everywhere. I can step out my door and be on a parkway in a few minutes and be for hundreds of miles on parkway, literally hundreds of miles. So, You know, it's that kind of place. You get used to a lifestyle like that, and it's hard to go someplace that doesn't have those things.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you had then growing up had a lot of exposure to literature and to writing and to writers in particular, right?
Well, I mean, it's always been here, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the state's literary heritage goes back a long way, and
Oh, yeah.
I mean, but I wasn't aware of it when I was a kid. I wasn't, in
Yeah.
fact, what's that?
Yeah, your kids are rarely aware of anything.
It's true, it's true. I was especially unaware as a kid, though. You know, all I wanted to do was go outside and play catch with a football or go skiing or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't long before I realized it. I mean, as soon as I sort of realized that I wanted to be a writer, which was more or less in high school, I mean, it wasn't more or less in
Right.
high school, it was high school, I started looking around and, you know, paying attention to who was here and what was going on. And there was always something going on. But it's sort of, I don't know if I've just become even more aware of it in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years, or if it's actually gotten so much bigger in the last 5 or 10 years. But it really is, you know, I mean, it's frankly amazing, actually, that the presses that we have here, the authors who live here. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, this place is rotten with writers. And just all the other things that go on, all the different reading series and
Oh, yeah.
the Loft, which is one of the sort of premier you know, writing non-affiliated writing programs in the
Right.
country is here. And yeah, I mean, it's remarkable.
I'm fascinated by that because I'm incredibly jealous. It's
Yeah, you know, I mean, I hate to get talking about it because it sounds so much like boasting, but it really is. Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of writer pals. That happens when you start doing this, and everyone is, if not envious, at least in awe or appreciative of how fantastic it is up here. And that includes, you know, all the cool kids out in New York and out east and out in California and elsewhere too. So yeah, not necessarily the same thing down in Kansas, huh?
No,
Yeah.
yeah, that's
Yeah.
kind of dismal. There's maybe a handful of writers here in Wichita. Most of them like to hide.
Yeah.
And the ones that are involved with the MFA program at Wichita State, I hesitate to say anything too negative about them, but they're very insular.
Yeah.
They don't like to get out and engage with the community, which frustrates me. 'Cause I kind of, the great thing about being a writer is you kind of get to choose your lineage. You know, what writers you read and you admire and you try to emulate, or the ones you want to associate with, you choose that lineage. And my lineage goes through the Beats, Ginsberg and Waldman and Kerouac. And I went out to Naropa, and one of the things they stressed out there always was being what they called mindful and being engaged with the community. And this idea of hiding out in the MFA program and not engaging the community just baffles and frustrates me.
Yeah, I can see it. Did you go to graduate school at Naropa?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't I guess I didn't really ever consider it, though I always looked at it with a sort of awe. It looks so cool to me.
Oh,
I
but
took for
it's
granted that I could never get into most places, and in fact couldn't. But anyway, yeah. So that I
well,
bet that was pretty formative, huh?
it I found it I it was incredibly expensive is what it
Oh, yeah.
was.
Yeah.
And they didn't offer, teaching fellowships. I don't think they do still. So it's kind of all on your own dime.
Yeah.
But I've had a lot of conversations with fellow students, people that I went with, and yeah, we grumble about the student loan debt, but none of us would trade it in for anything.
Yeah.
Those 2 years were massive. Their summer writing program makes it one of the largest visiting writing programs in the country, because they drag in, 20, 50, I don't know how many total writers, but enough to fill up 4 weeks worth of of classes for
Yeah.
hundreds of students,
Yeah.
and they cram them in there.
Is that in Boulder? I mean, it's in,
Yep.
it is Boulder. Yeah, plus you get to live in God's country there. It's beautiful up there.
Yeah, I miss it, but you did your undergraduate at the University of Minnesota, right?
It's true. Yep, I did.
Majored in English and creative writing, or
Exactly. Yep.
yeah.
Yeah, I kids I always joke that I'm an English major three times over. Yeah.
Yeah,
It all
I
started
bet.
there, though.
I'm trying to I don't remember if he taught there or not, but do you know Alex Pate?
That name rings a bell, but it was never a teacher of mine. What's the story?
He is his first book, I think, was called Losing Absalom. He was picked by Steven Spielberg to write the novelization of Amistad that landed on the bestseller list.
Yeah, no, I don't
His
know who
last,
that is.
he might.
The name does sound familiar, but and he lives here? Or he did?
Yeah, I think his
Yeah.
university. That's what's kind of curious. Yeah, it would have been University of Minnesota.
Yeah.
The last novel he published was West of Rehoboth.
Yeah, that boy, it just all sounds vaguely familiar, and that's weird because I'm pretty hip to who's around town.
Well, I think
I'll
he
have
taught mostly in African American studies, and
yeah.
had a class on the poetry of hip hop or something like that. But he
Yeah.
came and taught a summer at Naropa and had a tremendous impact on me as a writer.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to look into that. I don't know. Yeah, I'm virtually certain that he wasn't a part of the English faculty, or
Yeah.
the creative writing faculty, because I was sort of ogling them even back when I was an undergraduate, and didn't come across Alex. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
Who was on the faculty up
Well,
there?
back then, well, and it's largely the same faculty, but Patricia Hampel was my teacher as
Oh,
an
wow.
undergraduate,
Okay.
and a few lesser-known writers you probably haven't heard of, a woman named Madeline Springnether, who's mostly like a University Press type writer, and David Troyer was there, and Ray Gonzalez was one of the poets there. And now Charlie Baxter is on the faculty,
I've met him.
and what's that?
Charles Baxter?
Yeah,
I've
yeah.
been in touch with him a couple of times. He came down to Watermark here in Wichita and did a reading, and I was kind of hovering in the back off the clock. It was back when I worked there. And I guess he kind of has that radar for sulking writers, and he caught me at the register and we had a brief conversation.
Yeah, he's famously cool, I mean, he's really generous with his time. I don't know him well. I've met him a couple of times. But he's known not just around here but elsewhere as being that kind of cool guy, not certainly for his, I guess in our circle, certainly his sort of relative fame. He's not
Right.
a he's in no way a jerk about it. So I'm not
Oh,
surprised at
yeah.
all to hear that he was chewing the fat with you a little bit. Yeah. What are you what's going on with you writing wise? It's been what,
It's been
three, 4 years
4 years.
since?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. I was struggling after graduate school. That's when I had done most of the work on the evolution of shadows was while I was in school and immediately after. And then it took me 7 years to get that one published.
Yeah.
Which, when you bang your head against the wall enough, it kind of makes you dizzy and woozy, and I wasn't being very productive there for a while. I was considering becoming a plumber.
Yeah. Yeah.
And suddenly, Fred and Unbridled bought the book, and for about 6 months or so, I was scrambling, because I knew I wanted to get something out again quickly. And the only manuscript I had laying around was one that had kind of died about you know, halfway through my 7 years of getting the first one published. So I went back and polished that one up and sent that to Fred, and he didn't like it. So I went back, and he had had some valid points on it, because I've since gone back and worked on it again, and there's this spot about three quarters of the way through the book where I don't know how I got past it, but it's definitely a corner that you can't get out of. So, yeah, that's kind of where it is. And then I wrote another manuscript, and by the time I got done with it, Unbridled was going through that phase where they weren't buying anything. And so Fred generously, you know, let me go to find another publisher. So that's where I'm at now.
Have you had any feedback or any tickles at all?
No, not yet. Fred had some good things to say about it. But yeah, I haven't, problem is I spend most of my time not having any confidence in the manuscript right now. One of those tough things, but always writing on something.
Is the fact that they're back, relatively back in business on Bridal, have you thought about going back with it again, or have you guys established that you're not going to publish it at Unbridled?
I've been afraid to ask him.
Did you had a good I'm sure you had a good relationship with him, didn't you?
But I always had kind of a spotty, I don't have really, I have a difficult relationship with father figures.
Is he like that?
Well, I pretty much any older man is like that to me. I don't. It's a weird situation. I've never really been comfortable around men or that are old enough to be my father.
That's strange, huh?
It is. It is. I find it very strange, but it's definitely arises out of my own little conflicts. But
Well, good luck. Good luck placing it.
I thank you. I hope I've been getting a little bit of encouragement and help from Stu Abraham, so that'll be all right.
Stu from
Abraham Associates.
I just saw just yesterday. I saw Steve Horowitz. Who was his old partner? I don't think they're part. I mean, Steve retired.
God, if you ask him about me, he's going to tell you one particular story.
If I ask Steve about you, what's he going to tell me?
Well, this is back before I sold the book to Unbridled. I had gone up and I was working at Watermark Books down here in Wichita, and we went to a bookseller's convention in Omaha, Nebraska. And this was just after Andrea Portis's book Hick was released. And they were pushing that book hard. And I met Andrea up there. Got to talking, and Steve was, we were sitting at this author's dinner, the booksellers and everything, and Steve was pushing her book, and, you know, my internal editor is weak, as it probably should be. It's a little too weak sometimes. And so I kind of, he was talking about it as if it were this semi-autobiographical first-person Bildungsroman. And which is something that I absolutely dislike, because it seems to be the required first novel for writers that come out of certain graduate writing programs like Iowa.
Did Andrea go to Iowa?
No. But her book did. It wasn't. It was first person. It was a Bildungsroman, but it was very loosely autobiographical, not in the way that a lot of these are. And I apparently kind of went off on Steve Horowitz about how much I hated
first-person
Bildungsroman right in front of Andrea after he was trying to sell her book.
Oh, jeez.
And apparently he's He loves to tell that story every time he gets around somebody who knows me.
Yeah, that's a funny story.
So I put my foot in my mouth, and repeatedly it seems to be a habit.
Yeah, well, you're not alone in that camp either. I'm sure. Oh, it's so she's a young woman, isn't she? Or, I mean, she was when that book came out, anyway.
Yeah. Well, she's married, got a kid now. She's got another book coming out, or it might already be out, called Bury This. I don't remember who it came out with. I've got a galley around here somewhere.
Huh. I have to look
it on my list to read.
Yeah. I'm going to look into it.
So I want to know about the University of New Orleans. Because how long was that program? Is that a 3-year?
It was a 3-year program. The deal, I got a low residency MFA from the University of New Orleans. So people always say, oh, New Orleans, fantastic. You know, what was it like? And I had a great experience there, but I was only actually ever in New Orleans a handful of times. And I spent way more time on Bourbon Street than I did on the University of New Orleans campus.
Right.
So, my familiarity with the city and with the university there is scant at best. But the program itself was absolutely fantastic. And, my mentor, I don't know if they were officially called mentors or not, but it was certainly the attitude that we were expected to have about our teachers. The main guy that I had down there was a Canadian writer named Joseph Boyden, who has gone on to a pretty considerable career. He won the Giller Prize up in Canada a couple of years ago for not his most recent book, but the book before that. The Giller is sort of the Canadian equivalent of the Pulitzer National Book Award or whatever. And he was a great teacher. I mean, just a fantastic teacher, and he's stayed a good friend. And I really, of all the teachers that I've had, he's had the most influence, that's for sure. So that came out of that program. And that, and in fact, that relationship was really, except for the degree itself and a couple of wonderful summers abroad, the residencies were overseas, and I did 3 of them. So I guess I was actually in the program for about 2.5 years.
Right.
But it included 3 residencies.
Wow.
So the first 2 were in Prague, and the third one was in Madrid. So it was a summer abroad, in these, just amazing cities. And I got to know both Prague and Madrid pretty well. So, it was just absolutely fantastic, the program was, for all those reasons. But like I said, I'm no aficionado on the University of New Orleans itself.
Is Prague still kind of an expatriate literary scene there, or is it?
It is very, it is, Prague, I haven't been in Prague for, I guess it's been 10 years. That seems amazing to me. but as of 10 years ago, Prague is a city that's a lot of things. I mean, it's incredibly cosmopolitan, touristed for sure, and in that way expatriated. But I don't know the Czech Republic and Prague in particular are home to Kafka, which makes it very much Kafka's city.
Right.
And there's I think that in Václav Havel is from Prague and was president of the Czech Republic for all. So there's all those things that make it a little more literary than usual. But I don't know that it's a hotbed for, European literature or anything like that. I certainly, I pay some attention, but I don't know, I couldn't name 5 contemporary Czech writers, that's for sure. Yeah.
So who are, aside from the instructors that have had an influence, who are your guys that you carry around in your hip pocket?
Wow. There's a lot of them. I think, this is the sort of question that always stupefies me because the list is so long, but the short list of writers that really have influenced me, especially in the last whatever 10 years of my life or something, include Cormac McCarthy. I know I'm not alone in that.
Right.
With that influence, I'm a big fan of a writer named Bruce Mahart. Who has just a couple of books out. One of them was a novel called The Wake of Forgiveness that came out the same time as Safe in the Sea, which, whatever that was, 2010, I think. So it's been out for that long. And it's really the most beautiful and sort of brilliant book that I've read by any of my contemporary pals, you know. Who else? I'm a fan of David Vann. I love Annie Prue, although it's been a while since she's had something new. Mm-hmm. Up here in Minnesota, you can't get around much without acknowledging Louise Erdrich. She's a favorite. There's a whole list of them. I love John Casey. He wrote a book called Spartina a long time ago, and then a book called Compass Rose not too long ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, a follow-up called Compass Rose. I think he's just fantastic.
Okay.
Oh yeah, the list. I mean, the list could just go on. Better to cut me off, or else.
No, I just like I said before, it's lineage always fascinates me because we do get to choose it.
Right. I mean, it's interesting to hear that said. I've never thought of it that way, and that seems like a really thoughtful and true thing. To think about it in those terms, because it is, at a certain point you start making very conscious decisions about what your who your influences are and what about those influences you're going to be inspired by and try to emulate. That's fascinating. I like that notion a lot.
I guess the reason it's so important to me is because I grew up out in Dodge City, Kansas, so there were no writers out there. I didn't know, I had the Scholastic Reader program that, in grade school, and that was about the extent of it. I don't even remember there being a serious bookstore in Dodge City when I was growing up, except maybe like a Walden Books in the mall.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I came out to Wichita and there wasn't much going on writing wise, and I kind of got involved with being a writer because of some worksheets a sixth grade teacher, handed out for, Art Friday. It was a creative writing exercise.
Yeah.
And it tapped into that natural born pathological liar side of me.
Right. No. Right. I love to say that we lie for our living. So what do you expect from us? And when it comes time to say anything. Yeah. That's a cool story. So Go ahead.
I didn't even know I could major in English or creative writing till I took my freshman orientation tour at K-State, and I was looking through the catalog at the list of majors. I thought I was just going to major in journalism, and I saw there was English creative writing. It blew the top off my head, and I said, I'm majoring in that.
Oh, that's a cool story. So what is it that's kept you down there all this time?
Family, bad choices, and circumstance.
Yeah. The trifecta. Yeah. Yeah. I've heard that story before, man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well. If it weren't for bad choices, I wouldn't have made any choices at all. So at least there's some momentum in one direction or another.
Yeah, that's well said also. What about you? When you look at your own lineage, where do you trace it back?
Well, I think the first real writer that I got obsessed with was Stephen King, and that I quickly tired of that. I guess, and then of course a lot of science fiction, Orson Scott Card, weird stuff like that.
Yeah. Then,
because there wasn't really anybody around to teach me or direct me or show me. And the stuff they teach you in high school when you're not in the AP classes is out of the giant lit anthologies.
Uh-huh.
And those are always the worst stories by good writers.
Yeah, exactly.
And the teachers always are sitting there going, they're looking for one particular answer. What is the symbol here?
Yeah.
And
Well, there must have been a detour somewhere, though, because Evolution of Shadows certainly isn't inspired by Stephen King or Orson Scott Card. I mean, I should say, I hate to kiss ass out of nowhere, but I read your book when I don't remember if it was before Unbridled and I originally signed or right after I had heard it, and I was trying to sort of get caught up on the press, and I read like three or four books by Unbridled all in a row, and yours was one of them, and they were all it all just sort of proved to me what a great job they did in selecting their titles. I loved your book. I thought it was beautiful.
You,
yeah, yeah.
I'll return the favor here in a minute because I've got both of your books here in front of me, and I'd love to see you sometime in person so I can get you to sign them.
Oh, you could always count on that for sure. Absolutely.
But let's just jump right into the mutual appreciation because I picked up Safe from the Sea. And I spent, this was in the fall of 2010, correct, when that came out?
God, yeah, my mind is such a mess on this. I think it was, yeah, like autumn of 2010. It's, yeah.
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 Because I left Watermark right about the time when my book was published. But I still, you know, am tied to the bookstore very heavily because my girlfriend's the inventory manager.
Uh-huh. Is still?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, they
so you're
always
always
tell
hip. You're hip to everything that's coming out if she's the inventory manager of a store like Watermark.
I try to be.
Yeah.
You know, they told you, they always, I don't know if you got the same advice I did, but they said, make friends with your independent bookstore.
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I took mine to bed.
Yeah. Nicely done, sir.
But no, I spent... Yeah, it had to have been the fall because I remember making recommendations to the staff up there going, this is a book that you can push on dads and sons and stuff like that. I absolutely adored it because this came out, well, my father had died that spring.
Oh, geez.
And I found this book particularly moving with the relationship between the father and son. It's one of the things I'm obsessed with. And when I find books that deal with it well, that deal with it with grace and compassion, I really appreciate it. I love that. So that book sticks with me a lot.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
But yeah, the transition happened when I majored in English.
Ah.
I got into the first lit class, and I was suspicious because I'd been mistaught literature my whole life. And all I wanted to do was write stories. And then I got into that lit class, and the instructor was like, you know, whatever you think is in the story is in the story if you can back it up. And again, the little light bulb exploded in my head.
Yeah.
And I realized, oh, wait. And that's when I stumbled into Hemingway and Kerouac at about the same time.
And yeah, I can see Hemingway in your book. I mean, the war story part of it, and yeah.
And then Naropa happened. I went up there in 99.
Okay.
For the graduate program, and Michael Ondaatje was there my first summer. And that was when I discovered The English Patient and you know, a bunch of other interesting writers that weren't doing, you know, short declarative sentences and stuff like that. And that
right.
blew my mind. So,
right. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. A far cry or a mighty leap, I should say, from Stephen King to Michael Ondaatje, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to think though that what I do draw from the early science fiction and the Stephen King and the horror and all that stuff I read was, the ability to recognize and use plot and then break it when I want to.
Yeah, yeah. I think actually one of my, not just my, but a lot of other writers that I know as well, one of our big faults is that we haven't read enough books like that, you know, books that are sort of centered more on the simple art of storytelling. There's always these other conceits that we're caught up with. And
right.
I don't know. I have a good friend, a guy named Ben Percy, who I guess he's on probably his, what is it now, his fifth book is coming out next year. And he started out writing literary short stories, and then he wrote a literary novel, and last year he came out with this sort of big blockbuster book called Red Moon. And we spend a lot of time talking about, that it's not even a gray area. I mean, it's a black and white issue, according to most people, of the difference between what makes a book a genre book and what makes a book a literary book. And he's just opposed to the whole notion of it. And his
Oh,
book,
yeah.
though, it has, vampires and terrorist plots and things like that. Not, I'm sorry, not vampires, werewolves.
Right.
It's absolutely literary. I mean, it has all the hallmarks of from beautiful writing to really tight thematic structure and themes and everything else. And at the
Nope.
same time, I mean, I couldn't put it down for the reason that I can't stop watching a Star Wars movie or something,
Right. That was called Red Moon.
I'm trying to think when it came. I think it was just this spring, so 6 months or so ago, 7 months ago, it came out.
I can find it, and if not, I know who can.
I mean, I mean, it's one of those books. Who knows? Probably had a 200,000 copy first print run, so it's out there. You don't have to look far.
Now, did you actually go to Western Michigan, or did you do an extended thing like
The
that in New
Western, I
Orleans?
actually yes, the Western, I actually went.
Wow.
Kind of a little bit. I should be careful what I say. I don't want to denigrate it, but a little bit under
Right.
fault. I think of it often as having been bait and switched. That is, the woman who recruited me to go there. Her name was Jamie Gordon. She actually won the National
One
Book
that,
Award a few
yeah.
years ago. But before she was famous, she was a lifelong teacher at Western. And I met her in Prague, and we hit it off. And she's a really interesting, a little bit eccentric woman, but very cool and sweet and smarter than anyone I've ever met. Absolutely, unequivocally smarter than anyone I've ever met. And she's said, "Oh, come on down. You can just take a look around, see if you like it. The reality is, you come here, you get funded for 4 years, and it's just a great chance to just sit around and write." I'm like, I get funded, sit around for 4 years and write that. Nothing sounds better in the world than that. So I signed up,
Yeah, I bet.
but it was, I mean, I hardly did any writing.
Wow.
And the only sitting around I did was between trips to the library and the classroom. And it was an incredibly grueling academic, program, which of course it should be. I guess I just wasn't prepared for it.
Right.
And I mean, I loved a lot of it and really learned a lot while I was there. But I wrote one story the whole time I was there,
Wow.
one 20-page story in a program that lasted that long. And the piece of paper hanging on my wall is fine, but I don't know that I wouldn't have been better served just going and really putting myself in a room and writing for 4 years. But
Yeah. Now, was that where you ended up editing with Third Coast, or was
yeah,
that
that's
so?
right. That's right. Yeah.
What was that experience like? I mean, I've kind of manufactured my own editorial experiences, again, because of those bad choices and circumstance.
Yeah.
I didn't, get into the classes
Yeah.
and extracurricular stuff, so.
It was a ton of work.
Right.
Really, the sort of position that should have, it was, what happened is, we were each required to teach, I don't remember if it was one or, no, it was two classes each semester. But as editor, you only had to teach one class each semester. And so it was like half funded. So that was supposed to be the relief. And the time then that you would spend working on the magazine. Of course, you spend, I mean, it was a full-time job. I mean, it was
Right.
for at least for 2 or 3 months, twice a year, it was a full-time job, much more than teaching a class would have been. And it was a ton of work and it was very stressful, but it was also really, I mean, of all the experience that I gained there, that was right up there, you know, in terms of not only what I learned, but making connections and, and just really seeing the literary world from the point of view of the other side, you know. I don't think I ever want to be an editor or anything like that, but it was interesting to see it, and I think it served me well in my professional life, having had that experience. And I love to look back at the you know, issues that we published and see some of the writers that we published. And you know, I mean, a lot, it's not like I have a bunch of people to brag to this about, but I mean, we published Donald Ray Pollock before he was, you know, famous, and Laura Vandenberg before she was famous, and Amanda Boyden before she was famous, and the list goes on and on and on.
Cool.
So it was cool to, you know, to have, I guess, sort of, I don't know if it's just accidental or if there's any suggestion of competence or something there, but you know, a lot of writers have gone on to good careers, you know, at least good young careers. And I love that part of it. I love thinking that we had a little something to do with that.
Good eye. That's what it is.
Yeah.
So, okay, now I need a little help with the time frame here.
Okay.
You said you were in Prague about 10 years ago. So what years were you an undergrad?
I was an undergrad. So I started as an undergrad right out of high school, actually a year after our high school. I took a year of high school off and was a ski bum. And then I started as an undergrad and didn't do well. And then spent, sort of ballpark years on this. I don't know that they're exactly right. So say I started college in 1990, went to college for a couple of years, and then, basically took time off, or maybe the more proper way of saying it was asked to take time off. did a bunch of things, spent a lot of time working, for Barnes and Noble. And I actually enjoyed it and I learned a lot and I read, I mean, it was of all the reading experiences I've had, I read more good books working at Barnes and Noble than I ever did anywhere else, you know, certainly than I did in college or graduate school. So did that and then went back to school, in like 98. I got married in 97 and went back to school in 98 and finished my undergraduate degree in, I want to say 2000.
Okay.
And then went straight into the low res program at New Orleans. So did that from say, I must have started, I don't even remember, must have started in the winter of 2000 or maybe it was the winter of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Had my first residency then right after that. Did 3 summers of that. And then after my third summer, went straight into the PhD program.
Wow.
So, just terrible with this. It must have been 2003 or 2004 when I was in Madrid, came back, started the PhD program, and then went straight through and finished that, and then moved back to Minneapolis.
Wow. So when did you start writing Safe from the Sea?
I wrote most of Safe from the Sea. It took a long time to write Safe from the Sea. I started it when I was in the program at the University of New Orleans, started and finished a first or second draft at the University of New Orleans. Sort of shelved it, thought a lot about it and really thought about, I knew that it was incomplete and, or maybe too complete is more like it. I mean, it was twice as long in its original finished form than it ever was published. So had to figure out how to, you know, trim the fat.
Right.
And spent a couple of years working on it at the University of, at Western Michigan University. And then when I was finished at Western, took another year to really get it shaped up and into what I hoped and thought was maybe saleable shape. So it was,
Right.
you know, it was a, sort of went in big chunks of time with that one. Yeah.
Wow, that was a long process. How long between the time you had it in saleable shape did it take you to land with Unbridled?
Boy, you know, it didn't take long once my agent had it, but it took me a while to find an agent. And this is again,
Oh no, that I want to hear about that.
No,
How
the
long
agent
did it
part of
take
it?
you to find an agent? Because I
Oh God.
never have found an agent.
It was the most brutal thing I've ever gone through. I mean, if you've efforted, then you have a sense yourself, no doubt. But I'll try to be as right about this as I can be, although I'll inevitably be telling only some half truths. I think I started. I bet I spent 6 months sort of straightening up the manuscript and before I started looking for an agent. And
wow.
Then it was my plan. This is the plan, the sort of unofficial story I told myself, that I was going to try 100 agents because I had heard somewhere that it was the 1% proposition
right.
to get an agent. I don't know if that's true or not. But I said, okay, I'm going to find 100 agents and query them and see what happens. And I certainly wasn't going to, you know, get the list of 100 together and then, you know,
right.
do it all at once. So I would find 10 and send it off to 10. I think I got up to about 50.
Yeah.
So I had about 50 queries out before I started getting any nibbles. I had a lot of really nice rejections. But they were all rejections nonetheless. And then my agent, her name is Laura Langley, and she was one of the first people I sent them to. I don't know why. Partly she was from Minnesota. She didn't represent a lot of literary novelists. That has changed a little bit since I started working with her. But
right.
I just had a feeling about her, and I sent it, and I was really kind of hopeful. I don't know what it was, but it was months and months before she got back to me, even though she was one of the first letters that I sent. I'm sure it was 4 or 5 or 6 months between
wow.
when I sent her a letter and when she called and said she wanted to represent me. And I said, yeah, I mean, I think I took the weekend just to make sure that I had all my ducks in a row and was confident about this. But it was a long time, you know, like, I bet it was, you know, at least 4 or 5, maybe 6 months even between the time I sent her a letter
right.
and the time that she called to ask if she could represent. And in that time, I think I sent out about, like I said, about 50 query letters.
Uh-huh.
And she was the only one who said that she, you know, she was the only one who was interested. But
wow.
as soon as I found out she was into, there was a flurry that weekend of people being in touch with me. and it was really strange. It was,
right.
you know, it was some karmic thing. But I went with her and it was a great choice because we have a tremendous working relationship and she's really a great woman and a terrific agent as well. So once
okay.
she had the book, I want to say that we were sort of officially in the process of trying to sell the book in the spring of, I guess it would have been 2009. And it was late that spring or early that summer that Greg got in touch, Greg Michelson and Umbrado got in touch. And I think that she sent it to a dozen people. And he was one of the first dozen people. And it was a mix of, you know, she went to some of the big houses.
Right.
And then a couple of mid-size and then a couple of smaller presses as well. And what was interesting, I guess, or unorthodox anyway, about what happened with Unbridled was that Greg called her and said that he really liked the manuscript, but that he had some concerns and some questions and wanted to know, was I willing to work on the book.
Right.
And I said, well, I said, you know, of course I am. I'm not certainly not above working on the book. Mm-hmm. And so he said, okay, and I'll be back in touch. Let me you know, basically mark up a manuscript and we'll talk after we do that. Well, who know, you know, a couple of weeks later or whatever it was, he sends back this manuscript with a lot of really thoughtful advice. Mm-hmm. And said, okay, take a whack at it and send it back. And my agent was pretty perplexed, I guess, that this is not common, you know, that
right.
usually that would come back with an offer. But it didn't. We were both kind of mystified, certainly me more than she. But, you know, so but I thought, what do I have to lose? No one else is buying this book right now. I'll at least mm-hmm. Play along. And so we did that a couple of times, and it actually got to the point where she said, okay, if he does this again, we're just going to say, you know, forget it. We're not going to do this.
Right.
It's time for him to, you know, to make an offer. You know,
right.
this is silly. And in fact, the next time it came back, it came with an offer. And so it was a long
nice.
Time, like a couple of months anyway, I think
mm-hmm.
that we were editing the manuscript before there was any, commitment from their part to me.
Right.
Yeah,
it is a little odd, but
yeah, but it's another one of those things. It's worked out because,
right.
You know, I mean, Greg and I have, I've learned so much from him, and we have a really
mm-hmm.
good relationship, I think. And, I really, really respect the job that he does generally, and especially respect the job that he's done on my books. I mean, he's helped make them
yeah.
both a lot better. So it's one of those things that it must happen for a reason because it's worked out so well.
Now, I have a tremendous amount of respect for both Greg and Fred. I think what they have been doing with Unbridled is tremendously valuable.
Yeah, I agree.
There is not a disappointing book on their list.
Yeah,
mind excluded sometimes.
That's not true at all. That's not true at all. I know that.
Right.
But I know I have that same feeling. And I think, you know, people often, you know, people are around here are so,
mm-hmm.
oh, what's the word? You know, they're so aware of and sort of are fans of the small presses that we have
right.
here, Grey Wolf and Milkweed and Coffee House,
Coffee
you know,
House.
To name just... you know, the forerunners, but, and I think that, Unbridled is certainly in that category, maybe not with, Grey Wolf, but with Milkweed and Coffee House. And, I always tell people that the difference is that these other small presses and so many small presses are working as nonprofit entities,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the difference with Unbridled is that although they may not be working for great profits, it's a more traditional business model, which only
right.
makes it more impressive to me, you know, that they're
yeah.
picking books that not only have the literary integrity that they want them to have, but
right.
also, you know, are running a business, an honest business, not that the other businesses are dishonest. I don't mean that in any way, but you know, an old fashioned for-profit business. And
right.
I think it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I wish they could get, I wish some book they publish someday would get a big award. I think that would help them out tremendously.
Yeah.
And I think that's been the one thing that's kind of made it difficult for them is that, yeah, I mean, everybody in the industry has wonderful things to say about Unbridled. You know, but again, for some reason, with the general reading public, there's just something that's not quite getting over the...
Yep. Yep.
Over, and I don't know what it is because it's, yeah, there's not a dud. There aren't duds on that list.
Yeah,
so.
I completely agree. And in fact, not only are there not duds, but I mean, what have I read now? You know, a dozen or two dozen Unbridled books, and,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, there's some incredible books, yours included in that list of books. And I mean, it's just, it's such a crap shot, all that.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Award stuff and the prestige that goes along with it and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But man, yeah, that would be a boon for them.
Did you ever, were you ever on any award committees or win an award when you were in grad school or as an undergrad?
I was not. I was on an award committee. We, as editors of Third Coast, we awarded the Prague Summer Fellowship. I did it 1 year. I was the chair of that board 1 year. In fact, the year that Amanda Coplin, who wrote a book called The Orchardist that has sort of taken the world by storm in the last year, we published, selected her story called The Orchardist and awarded her the fellowship. But otherwise, no. And as far as winning awards, I've won a couple of awards for the books, small awards for the books.
Right.
But, you know, certainly just very small. Very small awards.
I was curious because the really, I mean, I think we've, well, when I was at Naropa, I submitted something to the Atlantic's student writing competition, and got an honorable mention. It was really thrilled about it. And one of my instructors, Keith Abbott, goes, "Well, you know, that's all just kind of political." And I kind of looked at him for a minute. He goes, "What it is, there's somebody on there who said, I will help you get your story first place if you at least give my guy an honorable mention." Right? And I was like, man.
Yeah. I think that goes on all the time. And if it's not that overt all the time, then, you know, there's something, there's a lot of, I don't even know what the hell the word is for it, but
haggling.
Haggling, yeah, people in people's pockets, that sort of notion. I have stories to tell. I mean, I know I can't tell them in either for public consumption or without a few cocktails in me, but stories about pretty big things happening for pretty peculiar reasons in the literary world. But you know, I don't really. Of course, it would be nice to be a part of that, you know, to have that sort of influence or to be the beneficiary of that sort of influence.
Oh, yeah.
But I also think, I don't know. I mean, even if you have that influence, you have to write a hell of a book and have a hell of a machine behind you to win the National Book Award or the Pulitzer Prize or something like that. And the odds are just so slim that if you get hung up worrying about it, you're a fool, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It is discouraging, though. No, I mean, like you say. Yeah.
So what are you working on these days?
Oh, I'm working, you mentioned earlier, like hitting your head against the wall. I feel like I've been hitting my head against the wall with this new book for a while. It's a sequel, a sort of an unofficial and not exactly sequel to The Lighthouse Road,
a
book that picks up with the same family in the same area of the world years later, but it's a really different kind of book. It's more of an sort of adventure story, a Jack London sort of adventure story. Yeah, and I'm having a ton of fun working on it, except that I keep making these huge errors in judgment and taking wrong turns and working for 100 pages and then realizing that I've made this terrible mistake and going back and having to, you know, essentially start over. And I've done that about 3 times now. I think I finally have it figured out and am working pretty swiftly now, which is not something that's been true for a while. So we'll see. I was hoping to have it finished before the end of the new year, but that won't be the case. But maybe by the end of winter, we'll have it done.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Oh, we'll see. I'm like I said. According to your stories, I've still got about. Well, I hit my 50 agent limit with the Evolution of Shadows, and I think I got maybe 2 or 3. You know, actual decent rejections. Everything else was a form rejection.
Yeah.
Gave up and finally sent it to small presses, and Unbridled was the third one.
Have you gone back to Agent Hunt subsequent to Evolution of Shadows coming out?
I'm starting to with this manuscript that I've got now,
and
that I don't have a lot of confidence in. But we'll see. It's a huge book. It's like 140,000 words or something.
That is huge.
And yeah, I don't know what to cut. I know there's problems with it. I don't know what to fix. I'm kind of at that point where I need somebody to, I don't know, kind of tell me where to cut.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I figure I either need to find an agent or find an editor or someone who's a very quick read.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's hard. Where's Maxwell Perkins when you need him, right?
Right. Yeah. Maxwell Perkins. Oh, well.
Yeah, exactly. We just keep on doing it, right?
Yeah, well, you know, that's kind of the way it goes, I guess. If you you keep banging your head against the wall, eventually the wall will break.
Yeah, exactly.
We hope.
Yeah. Or something, or we go crazy.
Yeah, the concussion kicks in, and then you just lose it.
or you go become a plumber, right, Jason?
They make a lot of money.
They do, a hell of a lot more money than writers make, that's for sure.
Don't you know it?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Yeah, but nobody remembers the pipes.
It's true, until they burst, and then, Yeah, it's a whole other apprenticeship. Yeah. I can't go through another education. I'm done learning new things. I don't even want to make new friends, much less learn new trades. You know what I mean? Yeah.
I think I understand, but I'm stick your neck out there. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, sir, I hope you get to feeling better soon.
I appreciate it. I hope I do, too.
And good luck with the new book.
Yeah, thanks. I'll you'll see on Facebook when I'm done with this, because I'll certainly be screaming about it when I am. And then hopefully there's a home for it, right? Hopefully we can each be trumpeting new books sometime in the next few months.
Oh, I hope so. Everybody's kind of forgotten who I am, I think.
I don't know if that's true. I don't think people forget books like yours. That's for sure.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, it was good. It was good to chat, and good to get to know you a little bit.
Absolutely. All right, there you have it, my conversation with Peter Guy. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to swing by in 2 weeks, where I'll have my conversation with Darren Dufresne. He's the author of The Salt Palace and the short story collection Inside and Out. I think you'll enjoy it. It was a blast. See you next week.